finance and economics. Provincial lessons. Keeping the flame alive. China's last boom towns show rapid growth is still possible.
China's economic miracle emerged from dozens of industrial entrepôts. Dongguan, famous for producing furniture and toys, as well as its many brothels, witnessed GDP growth of 21% in 2004. Hohhot, a town on the edge of the Mongolian steppe, posted growth of 18% in 2006 as it scarred its mineral-rich terrain with mines. Shanghai, the country's commercial hub, achieved 15% growth the next year as it churned out everything from machinery and textiles to cargo ships and steel, minting millionaires in the process. These towns have since slowed along with the rest of the country. Shanghai, which now has an economy 7.5 times larger than 20 years ago, saw its GDP grow by just 5% last year. Yet there remain places where growth, if not quite miraculous, is still mightily impressive, running at 8 to 10% a year. Most are small, county-level cities, home to something between a couple of 100,000 and a couple of 1 million people, and administered by bigger nearby conurbations. China's last boom towns are of great importance to Xi Jinping, the country's supreme leader, as he searches for ways to rejuvenate the economy, which in the second quarter of the year grew at a rate of just 4.7% year-on-year, down from 14.2% in 2007. The third plenum of the Communist Party, a highly anticipated meeting that ended on July 18th, underlined the importance of high-quality development, a goal that includes upgrading basic manufacturing to higher-value industries. The get-together also identified urbanisation and support for the private sector as crucial. For a sense of what this might mean in practice, consider Yueqing, an eastern coastal municipality of 1.3 million that last year still grew comfortably above 8%. In 2023, the town's GDP came to 166 billion yuan, or $24 billion, around the same in real terms as that of Dongguan in 2004. Visitors will take in Yueqing's many churches and temples, nestled among steep mountains, before they notice the factories. Its industrial district is a collection of thousands of tiny plants producing the smallest electrical appliances, such as circuit breakers, switches, and fuses. The town has been one of the world's main producers of low-voltage, low-value components since small underground operations emerged in the late 1970s, following Mao Zedong's death. How has Yueqing kept up a near-miraculous pace? Its entrepreneurial past helps, so does access to Wenzhou, a port to the south. But government policy, in the form of an intense upgrade plan, also plays a part. Officials have helped factories shift from basic widgets to valuable electronics. Yueqing has, for instance, become a leader in bonding wires, which connect parts and semiconductors. Policymakers encouraged Jiabao Technology, a local firm, to work with a nearby university. Together, they overtook the foreign outfits that had led the field. All told, 960 local firms are now considered to be high-tech by officials, meaning they produce high-value goods. 14 are listed on a stock exchange, a rarity for a town of Yueqing's size. Last year, Yueqing became the first county city in China to be referred to as a National Advanced Manufacturing Cluster. The title normally goes to larger cities that have built networks of enterprises in industries critical to Mr. Xi's idea of high-quality development. Its award is perhaps a sign that advanced manufacturing will, in time, spread from the hubs of Shanghai and Shenzhen to smaller towns. Diffusion would help with another problem facing provincial China, the loss of people. Between 2010 and 2020, 1,240 counties and county cities out of 1,866 saw their populations shrink, many by more than 20%, as people went to bigger cities in search of work. By contrast, Yueqing's population has grown. That, in turn, has helped it dodge the worst of China's property crisis. Cities hoping to follow Yueqing's path will face obstacles, however. Some local factory bosses sneer when the state is given credit for its success. After all, a distinguishing feature of the town, and others in Zhejiang province, is that firms are fiercely private, owing to their underground history. Few state-owned enterprises exist in the area, and locals pride themselves on being independent-minded. Many bosses are Christian, despite official distaste for the religion. A young leader at an electric switch factory says that entrepreneurs even avoid borrowing from banks, preferring to use informal lending networks that allocate credit much more efficiently. Where public policy has played a part, it has often complemented the strengths of private businesses. One measure hands out land to companies based on tax contributions and emissions. Local banks have been allowed to experiment with lending according to company performance, with low-interest, zero-collateral loans made available for leading firms. Many officials in the region have connections to industry, either as former business owners or as members of families that own small companies, says one boss. They tend not to intervene unless invited. The local government's role is to muster resources and foster connections, much like a consultancy. If this sounds different from the rest of China, that is because it is. Mr. Xi's time in power has featured a forceful demotion in the status of private business, which has been bruising for the country's most powerful tech entrepreneurs. Trust between businessmen and apparatchiks is low. The third plenum's report noted that the Communist Party must do more to assist the private sector. Perhaps, as Yue Qing demonstrates, the best way it can assist China's firms is by doing less.